Thank you, Tim. I thought I'd discuss trade secrets today, if you don't mind. No, I'm kidding. I'll discuss my other major area of interest. Can everyone hear me okay? Okay, great. So I want to thank, first of all, Sam Brailovsky, who initially extended the invitation to come here. I'm very excited to be here to meet with people that, at some level, I consider to be kindred spirits. I spent a large part of my youth going to record stores, digging through vinyl to try to find records that no one had heard of, certainly none of my contemporaries, and then received the ridicule and scorn of my classmates who were trying to figure out why I was listening to 78s when they were listening to music from the 1980s. So I'm excited to be here. This is an area of personal interest to me, and not only professional interest, so thank you for having me here today. Tim mentioned my background. I thought I'd just expand on it a little bit, since I know I'm an unfamiliar face to most of you. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. The Center for Internet and Society was founded by Professor Lawrence Lessig, who you probably have heard of, but if you haven't, has focused his recent part of his career on focusing on intellectual property law and technology law generally, with a very broad view of what it means for society to have the internet and to have the amazing technological capabilities that exist today. I am an employee of the Center for Internet and Society. However, like any good lawyer, I should start making disclosures and caveats immediately, which, if you've dealt with lawyers, I'm sure you've heard plenty of these before. The first caveat I'm going to offer is that I'm not speaking on behalf of Professor Lessig, that everything I say here today is my own opinion. And the second caveat I will give you is that I'm not offering legal advice, which I found I have to mention a lot when I start talking about these issues. And I can certainly empathize with people's concern about what the law really means, and I'll try to give you kind of a top-level overview of the Naxos opinion, and then also try to contextualize the opinion in a larger state of not only music, but intellectual property and specifically copyright law generally. So with that, I think probably the simplest way to start is to read to you exactly what the Copyright Clause of the United States Constitution says, because it really contextualizes everything about copyright law generally. Copyright law, right there, gives you a very indication of how far it goes back, because we're talking about law that predates the United States Constitution. A lot of copyright law and even the principles that exist today come out of English common law, which of course is the basis upon which American law at least began. And the Copyright Clause, which is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8, is written very clearly in the context of the Constitution. It vests Congress with the power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. That language, which is very, very simple on the surface, of course, has raised a number of issues from its inception right up to today. And today, of course, we're talking about the Naxos opinion and its impact in the future. Let me give you a very, very brief overview of the Naxos opinion itself, literally a minute. And then, by the way, at the end of my talk, I'd welcome any questions that you might have. The Naxos opinion basically boils down to what is increasingly becoming an issue in music preservation and music dissemination. The Naxos opinion said was very simply dealt with an issue of reissues of recordings in England that had entered the public domain at that time, but however were sold in jurisdictions where copyright law still existed. The facts of the case, at least for purposes of what I'm discussing today, are less important than what the holding really meant. Because what wound up happening is something which is really a revolutionary change in copyright law, at least on the state level. So the Naxos opinion said, in its simplest terms, that New York State common law, as it related to sound recordings, covers all recordings made prior to roughly 1972. And that federal law, which is a law that most people are familiar with and most people think about when they think about copyright, will not cover any of these recordings until the year 2067. So you can do some quick math on that. And if you take the control date, say, of 1890, when the first recorded sound came out, and I know many people in the room could quibble with the exact date, but I'll use 1890 for these purposes, we're dealing with about 177 years. So theoretically, we have recordings that exist today that may or may not be playable in modern formats, but certainly that might be playable under certain modern formats, that are still covered by New York State common law relating to copyright. It's a distinction with meaning. Federal law will cover all recordings that were made after 1972, but it is state law and not federal law that will cover sound recordings made prior to 1972. What does that mean for us? And by us, I mean people like yourselves who are in the music preservation, dissemination, archival business, but also for people that are focusing, as I have, on what the impact of technology is on our society and what the law does to it. Let me talk first of all about Naxos as it relates to music itself. So when we have a copyright law, as it exists today in the state of New York, that basically says that any recording made prior to 1972 requires the permission of the copyright holder for a remastering, a reissue, or indeed any copy, the impact obviously is profound. Tim Brooks, as I'm sure all of you know, has recently authored a study on sound preservation and reissues and really did a wonderful job in looking at what copyright law means. Specifically in the case of New York and in the case of the Naxos opinion, because it is the law of the state, what it means is preservation, for example, is subject to copyright. One could make the argument that a recording that is copied for purposes of preservation only is subject to New York State copyright law protection. And I'll discuss in a moment, by the way, what it means for someone who's not actually in New York, which is a question that often comes up and which is something that I think might be helpful to you as you think about this. So preservation is one area that's potentially impacted. Another area that's impacted, and something that I've focused on, is dissemination of those recordings themselves. The internet has really revolutionized, and I'm not saying anything profound here, the ability to share knowledge. And sound recordings are a wonderful example of it. The UCSB Cylinder site, which I'm sure most of you, if not all of you, are familiar with, is a perfect example of what we could be doing in sound preservation and dissemination and the spread of knowledge were the law slightly different. We have a medium here, the internet, which allows for people anywhere in the world to potentially access information that they would have no ability to access otherwise. And you add onto it the idea of a cylinder, which I recall seeing, by the way. My father had one or two on top of a bookshelf. I think one fell at one point. And of course, as you know, it shattered because of that particular cylinder. I always wondered what it would sound like if I could listen to it. Of course, I couldn't really find a cylinder player, and it didn't really occur to me that I could find one, so it kind of sat there as an artifact. The internet allows, and the technology, which many of the people in the room are far more familiar with than I am, allows for the conversion, of course, of those cylinders into a medium that I could listen to, as I do, on my iPod. What an amazing ability, what an amazing fact that we can do this today. And this can be done if the law allows for certain exceptions. One of those exceptions is fair use, which I'll talk about briefly in a moment, but I want to again emphasize the core idea here. Dissemination of these materials would require, under New York State law, the permission of the copyright holder. Many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the phrase orphan works, the idea that you can't find the copyright owner, or that it's even cost prohibitive or time prohibitive to do so. The orphan works issue touches on this. So again, to summarize what I'm saying at this point, preservation is impacted by New York State law, dissemination is impacted by New York State law. Now, I'm putting aside the issue of commercial reissues because I think that touches on many, many different issues that I'm not focusing on, at least when I look at Naxos. I'm really focusing here on the non-commercial aspects of copyright law and where New York State copyright law stands at the moment. I mentioned fair use, and I want to briefly talk about that. Fair use, as again, I keep saying many of you know, maybe I should assume that no one does, and then I'll be able to make the speech a little bit shorter. Fair use allows for certain very limited exceptions for an individual to use an otherwise copyrighted work without the permission of the copyright holder. Classic examples of that would be research, scholarly type work. The previous presentation, which was excellent, might be a perfect example of that. Using a recording for scholarly or research purposes would not, under fair use basic standards, require permission. Fair use, as it currently exists in New York, does not appear to apply to sound recordings. Again, what does it mean? We have a law which says in New York that all sound recordings copied for any purpose whatsoever must get the permission of the copyright holder. Copyright law generally. which I think is it contextualizes it a little bit better. One question that comes up, and I've answered this several times, and I think it's helpful here, is to wonder the basic question, why am I focusing on 1972? Why is pre-1972, post-1972 important? In a nutshell, 1972 was roughly the year. The 1976 reforms of the Copyright Act also impacted the act of this. But basically, 1972 was the year that Congress decided that federal law was going to apply to sound recordings. In other words, state law was no longer going to apply to sound recordings. What they chose to do, however, is to not make the law retroactive. In other words, they didn't say on a going forward basis, every recording that used to be covered by state law is now covered by federal law. They said on a going forward basis, federal law will apply after 1972. Interestingly, when you look at the legislative history of the 1971-72 changes, you find a very interesting statement that I want to read to you. This statement comes from an assistant attorney general who was solicited by Congress to offer an opinion based from the Department of Justice as to what they thought about this amendment. And I'm not going to read it all to you because not only would I probably put everyone to sleep, but I don't want to be reading too many things, but I do want to read this one sentence. Here's what they said. We believe that extending copyright to reproduction of sound recordings is the soundest, and in our interpretation of certain cases, Supreme Court cases, the only way in which sound recordings should be protected. Here's the key phrase, key sentence, excuse me. Copyright protection is narrowly defined and limited in duration, whereas state remedies, whose validity is still in doubt, frequently create broad and unwarranted perpetual monopolies. This is a statement from 1971. Now, I'm not talking about here the idea solely that we have a potentially 177-year term, because I'm not here to suggest to you, and I want to be absolutely clear, that I think copyright law is inherently bad. I think we need intellectual property law across the board, and we absolutely need these incentives to innovate, and we certainly want people who create things to be able to capture the financial rewards of doing so. But what I'm suggesting here is that New York is creating an absolute right. In other words, there are no exceptions, and there are certain exceptions that must exist. So I wanted to point that language out to you to give you an idea not only of how far this goes back to, but to also answer a very basic question, which I think confuses a lot of people. The focus of the 1971 changes, obviously, when you read the legislative history, was record piracy. The idea, obviously, that you have people who are copying materials for pecuniary gain with no authorization whatsoever. I am not here, speaking for myself, I'm not here to suggest that piracy is appropriate or right. It's clearly wrong, and it clearly should be illegal. But what of the non-commercial archive? That is where the copyright law as it stands today seems to be missing the mark in a lot of ways. We're talking about issues involving ownership of property, and who should control the rights to use that property. Now, certainly, I'm glad I gave the caveat that I'm speaking for myself, because I'm going to say some things that are pretty controversial, but then again, that makes for a much more interesting presentation anyway. Ownership itself should not necessarily be absolute, and fair use, which is the major exception for speech, is an example of that. Fair use is a First Amendment privilege. It's a First Amendment idea, the idea that there are certain expressions which should not require the copyright holder, or indeed the interested party's permission before you speak. You can imagine a scenario where you want to create any number of political ads or a political statement that has no particular party affiliation or candidate affiliation to criticize an elected official, but you need the elected official's permission before you put their name in it, before you put a picture of them, or what have you. There wouldn't be too much permission that would be granted, although there may be a couple of people who might go for it anyway. But the idea, again, is that there's certain speech that is more important than the copyright, is more important than the property holder. And I say more important in the very normative sense, meaning that it's a value that at least we found in congressional federal statutes and even in the Constitution to be more important. So we're dealing with issues of ownership. And there are a lot of questions that come up under New York state law, ultimately dealing with what can you do about New York state law, how does it impact us? The duration of copyright is something which, at least on the state level, was generally answered by an opinion called Goldstein versus California. And what Goldstein versus California said, and I'm simplifying it tremendously, but basically it said that state law that doesn't change or conflict a federal law, even as it relates to duration, for example, is not unconstitutional. So a challenge to the duration of a state law dealing with common law copyright, at least under Goldstein, which is, you know, the case right now that controls, is really a no-go. But what we're talking about here is really what the law means on the broadest scale, which is how the law is constraining creative activities. My boss, I've mentioned before, Professor Lessig, has written several books in this area. One book is his second book called The Future of Ideas. And The Future of Ideas is really a book and a trilogy dealing with this larger issue of creativity in a modern age. And in what I think will be my last reading of the day, I wanted to just quote you page 104 to 105, where Professor Lessig talked about creativity in the past versus creativity today. And here's what he said. The aim is therefore not to find a world without constraint. It is to remove the constraints that might otherwise inhibit innovation. Just because it is good that something forbid rambling paragraphs, it doesn't follow that a tax on books would inspire better writing. And he went on to say, creativity in the arts is affected by the constraints at the physical, code, and content layers. This is where I'm turning a little bit towards technology, but I think it's an important point. There's an enormous debate, and it's a fascinating debate no matter what side you come in on, dealing with how technology is impacting the activities and the rights that people previously had. The basic notion is that code, and when we're talking about code here, we're thinking about computers, code becomes law. This is a topic that Professor Lessig's written about, although there are a number of other people who have written about it over the last 15 years or so. But the basic idea is that it is the infrastructure, it is the computer, it is the way that something is programmed that is impacting how we do things today and what we can do. In other words, digital rights management, something which, again, is a major issue in the music business, is an example of code becoming law. A program is placed on a CD. The CD impacts one's ability to use that CD, again, whether it's right or wrong. It impacts one's ability to use the CD, and suddenly the code circumscribes what you can do and what you can't do versus the law itself. The basic idea is that as this technology becomes increasingly powerful, as its capabilities become really revolutionary and we're able to do things that we couldn't even conceive to have done before, we have to think about how far we want that code to go. We have to think about how far and how many rights we want to hand to people that are not in elected positions, that are not in courts, that are not making these decisions. We could debate, and it would be a topic probably that would cover a week, the idea of who's making right decisions and whether right decisions are coming out of the courts or coming out of government or coming from private industry, but there's an issue here. And the issue is code becoming law. Naxos and the idea that you have courts that are basically affirming the idea that certain rights are absolute is an example of code ultimately becoming law. The interests here of a commercial nature have, in effect, trumped other interests like the First Amendment. So Naxos, in a very fundamental way, fits into this larger debate about what we want people to do without permission, what we want technology to allow us to do without permission, what we want people to be able to do without any constraints that they're going to be called a criminal, that they're going to be charged with a crime, that they're going to be sued civilly, or what have you. And at least as far as Naxos goes, Naxos, the decision, which is from the highest court in the state, says very clearly copyright law is perpetual and basically until the year 2067, at which time federal law will pick up, and that's it. Do with it as you will. So we have an issue there, and we could debate at length about what could be done about it. I'd certainly welcome questions about the law itself and you know, ideas about it and your thoughts, but contextualizing at that large level is really the key. So where are we left? We're left with a situation where Naxos is a very, very important case, and it's a very, very important case for the people in this room, probably even more so than your average music listener. Because as I started off with, and I want to close my presentation with, we're dealing with a situation where a cylinder that was created in 1920, which was sold by Edison or Columbia or what have you decades ago, and which in all likelihood is not going to be sold commercially anytime soon is copyright protected. What it means is that making a restoration copy of that cylinder and being contacted by a scholar who says, I want to do a scholarly analysis of Harry Lauder's recordings, would have to get permission from the copyright holder under New York state law if that copy were to be given to them. What it means is that scholarly activity under the current state of New York state law is potentially circumscribed. And there are other ways that it's circumscribed. And what it means for us sitting here in Washington state, in terms of why New York law is important, it means that if that recording is sitting on a server in New York state, if you download it off the internet, potential violation of New York state law. It means, conversely, that if the recording is sitting in a state other than New York, but you download it while you're sitting at your computer in New York, a violation of New York state law. So we're dealing with another issue, which is how far state laws can go, but that would be a constitutional discussion that I'll leave for potentially some questions later, but for another time. I hope this has given you a general idea of what Naxos means, both the decision itself and in a broader context. I thank you for having me here, and I welcome any questions you have. Sir.
I want to go back to something about ownership, because I think something very basic to the Naxos case is EMI committed fraud. EMI sold to the American, to its American branch, something it did not own. They already admitted that the copyright had passed in England for the recordings that they sold. It was just as if they had sold the American branch Capitol Tower Bridge, or if they had sold to their American branch a Pi recording, or a Philips recording, or a Fontana recording. They didn't own the recordings that they sold to their American branch. So fraud was committed in the first place. They should not have been, under British law, under British courts, they should not have been allowed to sell that item. They didn't own it. So the whole case, in a sense, if Naxos would go back to British courts, charge EMI with fraud, the Naxos case would be moot.
I don't think I can comment on the Naxos facts itself. And perhaps I should also say that I don't represent Naxos. I'm not here as an advocate for Naxos. I'm merely discussing the context. But the issue, I think the interesting crystallizing issue there is kind of what I was saying at the end, which is how one state's laws or one jurisdiction's laws impact people outside that jurisdiction. These are the questions that it's difficult. The bottom line is this. I can't offer a legal opinion generally about what Naxos is doing, so I have to be very clear about that I'm not offering the advice. I will say this generally, though. Again, getting back to New York state law. New York state law seems very clear, and a Naxos decision makes clear, that we have a copyright that basically has few, if any, exceptions. So the business decision of Naxos is almost a separate question from what New York law currently says. And I know that's an unsatisfactory answer, but I'd be doing a disservice if I proffered an opinion without having the facts in front of me.
Okay.
But if you'd like to, okay. It's going to turn the basic answer is it will first turn on the laws of the state in which you're in. So that's the general question. The specific answer, I think you'd want to speak to an attorney to get a solid answer on that one, who isn't standing giving a public presentation. Well, there's okay. So it gets back to this extra jurisdictional question. Jurisdiction is the basic concept in law that the laws shouldn't theoretically apply everywhere. There has to be a connection between the law and the user itself. The question of whether, you know, which came up in Naxos, and as which this gentleman mentioned earlier, that the fact that you had a recording that was in the public domain in a foreign jurisdiction was ultimately, at least the decision of New York State Court of Appeals said, didn't impact the fact that each jurisdiction has a right to create its own laws. So at the end of the day, the New York State Court said, if you're in New York, you're going to be subject to New York law. So when you sell here, New York law is going to cover you. So I'll come back this way. Yes.
How is that restriction not violating
state
commerce
law? Okay. So I was afraid someone was going to say this. And not because I'm not happy to discuss it, but because it's a very complicated issue, which I'll try to summarize in the simplest way possible for those of you who were blessed not to go to law school and have to go through a con law class and figure this out. It's a fascinating area, but it's a tricky one. The Commerce Clause, which you referred to, is basically the idea that Congress or that the federal level. Congress and the executive branch have the right to regulate activities between states. The countervailing idea, and Professor Lessig will probably shoot me at this point because he's a constitutional law scholar and I'm sure I'm not doing it enough justice, but the countervailing idea is that the dormant Commerce Clause, quote unquote, is the flip side of the coin. And the flip side of the coin says basically that individual states cannot create laws that impact other states' commerce activities. So in other words, the idea would be that New York State couldn't say, we are going to criminalize this activity in New Jersey, because they're not New Jersey. With that summary, the answer to your question, yeah, it's a tricky issue. And there's a major dormant commerce clause issue here, in my opinion, when the New York State courts and New York State law has this impact. The question becomes, where it gets even thornier, is how much impact there is, what the state's interests are, and what have you. So the answer to your question in a succinct way is that is an issue raised by the Naxos decision. Yes. Yes, sir. Oh, I'm sorry. I was leaning back, but okay, sorry. And then I'll come this way. Well, I'm not sure I understand your question. Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, the decision was from the highest court in the state, but... Right. No, I understand that. But you're asking me to think about how they could go about suing an individual under Naxos. I'd be happy to think about that and come back to you with an idea on it. And I'll give you my contact information afterwards. And I'd be happy to exchange some ideas on that one. I'm sorry. Oh no. It's not that. I just want to give it some thought. Sir, I saw you earlier. Well, again, we're focusing there on state law. So under New York State law exists for recordings made prior to 1972, sound recordings until the year 2067. So I don't have...
X years after you make the recording, that's not...
Okay, yeah, let me try to explain that. The under federal law, the copyright law, as you may be familiar with, the terms of it have been extended repeatedly and more recently. That's dealing with federal law. So under federal law, basically, you'd have a situation where you have a 95-year term, just about, okay? But the distinction here, and it's a tricky distinction, is that because up until 1972, federal law didn't apply to those sound recordings. It was left to the individual states to decide what the term would be. As I mentioned, I was briefly mentioning the legislative history, Congress ultimately decided that piracy was a major issue and that the states, in effect, weren't handling it in a way that they deemed to be appropriate. So they said, you know what? We're now going to fix what was effectively a loophole in copyright law and apply federal copyright law to sound recordings. The result is the 1950 recording is covered by New York state law. The recording made in 1978, covered by federal law. Yes, sir. I certainly think that as I mentioned, it's a major issue in fair use, because fair use is really the prototypical First Amendment protection. It's what the Supreme Court in the Eldred opinion, which maybe you're familiar with, but an opinion a couple of years ago by the Supreme Court dealing with a challenge to the extension. I'm sorry? I think ultimately, are you saying it will encourage less fair use or more? Which way are you going with it? Okay. So the answer to the question, I think, and again, my own opinion, is that when you're dealing with issues of fair use, the fair use doctrine has always been one of those gray areas. There's a number of elements to it, and there's a number of factors that go in to decide whether something is, in fact, fair use. New York law, at least my reading of the Naxos opinion, is that New York law is very clear, and that fair use itself is not a concept that exists under New York state law for sound recordings. And I should make that also very clear. I'm speaking only about sound recordings here when I talk about New York state copyright law. There is a group of publishers that could be next door. There'd probably be a different discussion. I think New York state law, as it currently exists, clearly could encourage litigation. Which way it would go remains to be seen. The decision that was rendered in Naxos is a decision that's, at this point, a little over a year old. So we're not dealing with a decision that has a long history. And as one of the gentlemen mentioned previously, even though the New York State Court, the highest court, rendered that decision, the case went on from there for procedural reasons that aren't really relevant to my discussion. So it remains to be seen how it's going to impact things. I think, as I've made clear, I think it's going to have a severely negative impact, ultimately, on creation and innovation, at least in the sound recording area, not to mention the dissemination of knowledge. I saw a bunch of hands go up first, but why don't I go to, sir? Prediction as to change in the law. That really would be reading tea leaves. I think so. You've asked me to read tea leaves. So now that I've said that, I don't know. And I think it really boils down to what people's interests are in the law itself. Like I said, as is clear, as I tried to make clear at the beginning, you're not talking to an unbiased observer. This is not, a professor presenting a situation where I'm just throwing out the issues. I think I've made it very clear where I come down on it. Would I like to see the law changed? Of course. It really boils down to what people think is the impact of this law on their activities. Again, putting it through the crucible of a library trying to disseminate knowledge and trying to disseminate recordings that ceased to have commercial value decades ago, I think it's a very compelling argument. Obviously, if I were to stand up here and say, sir, a recording made in 1971 that you're selling today, public domain, might be a different opinion. So it really depends on how people come down with it. again, the point I'm trying to make here is that when you contextualize New York state law in the larger context of intellectual property law and copyright law specifically, it's endemic of the trend, which is to move away from fair use, which is to move away from exceptions and to create a broader, more very basic and blanket rule about ownership. Well, I think it's, you know, I can recommend, I meant to do this, I wanted to recommend perhaps some reading for those of you that kind of want to take a look at this issue in more detail here. There's a great book that came out that I actually have with me, and I have no interest in the sale of this book, by the way, but it's a book called Steal This Music by Joanna Demers. Ironic in the conversation we just had. Joanna Demers, and it's a book that just came out within the last, I don't know, it came out this year, maybe the last 3 or 4 months. Anyway, this D-E-M-E-R-S. The subtitle of the book really summarizes it, which is How Intellectual Property Law Affects Musical Creativity. I personally think it's an excellent overview of the issue in terms of the innovation side. The publisher is the University of Georgia. Well, again, I mean, I'm speaking generally. I'm not speaking about particular challenges to the law. What I'm suggesting is, at this point, is that the law itself does not allow for those kinds of behaviors absent permission. Sir. So I think your question really is goes to the issue of who or what will be enforcing these rights. So I can approach it two ways. The first approach is to say, when you're dealing with civil laws, and when we're talking about copyright law, I mean civil law as opposed to criminal law, where you have penalties and, you know, jail time and things like that, it's up to the rights holder to decide that they're going to enforce the right. It boils down to that. There are numerous examples in the fair use context of situations where you could make a fair use argument and none was made, or conversely, where you could say there was no fair use but no right was enforced. There's a very famous example of it, which is on point here, at least in the context of fair use. But I guess, again, I'm thinking in the last couple of years, a very clever work was done. What happened was, and some of you may be familiar with it, an individual took the Outkast song Hey Ya, which was popular, and still is popular, and basically superimposed it over clips of the Peanuts cartoon, and basically made it appear that the Peanuts characters were performing this song. That is an example of what clearly at least is arguable is a fair use. It's a new work based upon pre-existing works. The copyright holder for Peanuts basically said, you don't have authorization to do this, and we want you to remove it, and it was on various websites. Now, that particular video is difficult to find now. because basically different websites took it down. Obviously, if the rights holder hadn't put their hand up and wrote a letter to that particular, you know, website where it was and said, you're violating our rights, it would still be out there. So on the civil side, it's really a private right enforcement. That's kind of what I was talking about earlier about ownership. We're dealing with individuals that are afforded rights under the law, and then it's up to them to enforce it. On the criminal side, of course, you're dealing with a whole different set of areas, and to decide whether a prosecutor is going to enforce a law is equally as difficult as on the commercial side. So the idea of selective enforcement is that there's going to be no hammer coming down from the heavens just blocking this activity. It requires the enforcement of the right itself. But the law, as it exists in New York, is a very strong right. Ma'am. You're talking about the genesis of sound recording copyright law in New York? It goes back to, I mean, like I was saying at the very beginning, it goes back to common law generally. So we'll go even further back. The idea that an individual who creates something should have a right to profit from that creation is something that, like I said earlier, predates the Constitution. This was inherited from English common law. Yes. So the states themselves had to decide what that law meant for them. So each individual state, basically, as the issue comes up in court, suddenly creates the law. Now, you could have a situation where a legislature, for example, creates law itself, or a bill is passed. In the case of New York, because these were principles that were inherited from English common law, the courts basically created the law, which is an interesting issue in law generally. When you have courts creating law, it creates all kinds of issues as to what decisions mean and what the courts meant and then what those rights are. When you have a legislature of any sort creating a law, you often will have legislative history, like something I quoted you, where you can kind of have an idea of what the intent of certain words were, although sometimes words aren't defined. The answer to your question is, what is the genesis? The genesis really boils out of English common law as it was interpreted throughout, you know, the last 200 odd years in New York State. Well, okay, I think I can, and this is good because I think I can clarify some confusion here. The law itself, the reason why this issue came in front of the New York State Court of Appeals is because there was an open question as to what New York State copyright law meant for sound recordings and what the term was. So this was a case that went up through the federal courts, and to make a long story short, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the court, the second highest court basically that would cover New York on a federal level, said to the New York Court of Appeals, this is all the nomenclature that confuses all law students in their first year, the New York State Court of Appeals is the highest state court. The federal court said to the state court, tell us what New York state law is, because it's unclear to us. And then the Court of Appeals rendered its decision. So the reason why it came up, the reason why I'm talking about the Naxos decision as establishing this, is really to say that the New York State Court of Appeals affirmed what the rule is and said clearly, this is how we interpret New York state law. And we say New York state law exists, you know, generally as I described it. We're...
One more question.
Okay. Oh, God. Now, let's see, who am I going to anger and who am I not going to anger? Sir, I think I saw your hand up earlier in the blue, so I'm sorry. I appreciate all the questions, but I'm happy to answer stuff afterwards as well. Like I said earlier, I don't represent Naxos, and I have no knowledge of what they're doing. I mean, I'm really, you know, like I said, I have very strong opinions about it because it's copyright law, but I'm not involved in Naxos's decisions about appealing or not appealing. Thank you all very much.